Well, thanks for coming this afternoon. My name is Paul Rohde, and I'm calling this session Meeting God on the Way, the United States. Tuesday we did Meeting God on the Way and talked some about European pilgrimage sites. At least the history of immigrants in the United States is not nearly as old as it is in Europe. And Europe, as far as that goes, is still working out the whole relationship between their indigenous peoples and immigrants in terms of what is a pilgrimage and what is not. There are some scholars at the University of North Carolina who number between 6,000 and 7,000 pilgrimage sites in Europe, to which there are 60 to 7 million religiously motivated visits per year. I mentioned on Tuesday that that is growing exponentially. So I'd like this to be a workshop, kind of an exploratory discussion on pilgrimage sites in the United States. What would be our movement, our aims, our destinations. What I thought I would do is I'll put a few categories up here. I have, frankly, Trinitarian categories, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. It seems to me that there could be a group of sites that would have to do with creation. So good that I've got a green marker, and we'll put that in green. Among them would be things like water and mountaintops, deserts, wilderness. You get the picture. A lot's been written in the spirituality literature about the necessity of wilderness places, the necessity of wild places. What I'm interested, so I've got some categories, and I'll just be interested in your naming some places. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. Another thing I want to add to the creation one is our bodies. We are creatures. And Eugene Peterson says when Christians talk about getting back to nature, they mistakenly too quickly think about going to some outside place that is wonderful without appreciating the naturalness and the intricacies of the human body, that to explore our own bodies is to get in touch with nature and creation and the creative. And I think, I mean, am I not a witness to the physical power of pilgrimage? We are just off the trail. We were pumping all the way back from Cloudy Pass. We thought we'd allowed plenty of time, and we made it, so I guess we allowed enough time, but we didn't allow any too much time. So there are those creation sites. Under redemption, I think about one other thing I was going to say. We were on our way to Holden last week, so we only got to see one episode of the Ken Burns documentary on the national parks. I understand it's on its way into the village, but the episode we saw was just magnificent in terms of the power of creation and the honoring of that in the national park system. Redemptive sites, I think about places of historic import, and especially those that speak to some of the bondages that have been part of our story and some of the liberation. So for example, one site that really felt like a pilgrimage to me is the Martin Luther King Library and Museum in Atlanta. To go there and to see his birthplace and to watch the video footage of the oppression that he engaged, it was clearly prophetic. And it's powerful to go there and to see the place he lived and to see the footage on the very streets where you're walking. I think there it's possible here to put some of the service, mission, accompaniment, travel. So, for example, our campus ministry for each year now since Katrina has sent spring break groups to work on the recovery of New Orleans and other Gulf Coast cities, where they witness not only natural disaster, but some of the oppressions of history and attempt to make a difference. I put these all together. There are very important conversations happening between service learning, folks who lead service learning, and folks who do global mission on exactly what we call this movement toward other peoples. Accompaniment is about walking with people. That's the theology of mission of the ELCA. And frankly, is the theology that we put behind our service efforts too. Service can be really condescending. As if we go to make something better for someone else, as altruistic and as noble as that sounds, we're at least after some sort of exchange between people so that people give gifts as well as receive gifts. Those are categories that could be examples. The third article, for lack of better terms, I will go with personal, cultural kinds of travel. It seems to me that under the personal, it's the sorts of treks we make to ancestral homes. I think reunions can have a pilgrimage kind of character, a gathering of people, been part of our story, and that can be really powerful. Most of that, when I just tell people I'm going to do a session like this, most of the places they name are cultural. Somebody in the village said Branson, Missouri. People will say Disneyland, Las Vegas. I think as part of this workshop, we have to talk about those. Are those pilgrimage sites or not, and why? What sorts of experiences do we claim from those places? So I've given you some examples, I think, under each category. I'm interested not just in a list of destinations, but in the sort of story you would tell about the destination. So in what sense does it help us let go of ourselves, this experience we're calling liminal space? In what sense is it sacramental as we meet God there? We have an experience that is similar to an experience out of scripture. So is it clear what I'm after? We're just going to talk about some places we go and see if we get a sense of which of them may be American pilgrimages. Somebody have an idea? Linda has something to start.
Well, several people last night were talking about Ellis Island.
That's what I was going to say too.
You know, you go there and you look through all the names and you see if you can see your name or somebody in your family's name. And that it's been several years since I was there, but I found the visitor center to be really moving, and it made me think about my grandmother who came to this country as a teenager from Eastern Europe. I don't know if she came through Ellis Island or not, but you know, it made me wonder what her dreams were.
Right.
Well, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, great. For sure, we put that here, right?
Yeah.
I think there's a sense in which you also claimed it here. My uncle can get a picture at Ellis Island of the ship his mother came across on from Norway. Yeah, great. Good start. Other suggestions?
The Vietnam Memorial.
Beg your pardon?
The Vietnam Memorial.
Yeah. Would you put it here, historical?
Yeah. All of that stuff on the mall.
All of the mall on Washington, D.C. Yeah. And you know, I struggled with that. I've been in D.C. a lot lately, and I frankly wish there were monuments on the mall that were not just about wars. But I finally learned to appreciate that all around the mall is the Smithsonian Institution. So the tribute to the nurses and the teachers and the scientists and the explorers, the native peoples, the artists, that can be around the mall. But certainly the mall in Washington, D.C. is one. Others?
We're coming to Holden.
Okay.
And at least for those of us who have to travel a good distance, I do think it is a pilgrimage.
We're going to spend a week during work week and talk about Holden as pilgrimage. There's some things that I want to say about this as we get more examples up here, and maybe we'll relate some to Holden too. Do you want to say more about coming to Holden?
No, just another historic would be we visited several Civil War battlefields.
Yeah.
And to stop and think of what was, what happened there and what it was accomplished at each spot.
Mm-hmm.
And the sacrifices that were made.
Yeah.
And the Lexington and, you know, Boston, places in Boston.
Mm-hmm. And Philadelphia. And Williamsburg. If some of you met Catherine, the Unitarian Universalist pastor who was here from Michigan, she had to leave before this session, but she wanted me to tell you that for Unitarian Universalists, Boston is the historic site because of the Transcendentalists. So to go to Walden Pond, to Emerson's sites, Emerson's garden is reconstructed there. That was what she thought.
There also are sort of scientific, technological places like, you know, Thomas Edison's museum and historic thing.
Going to the ocean, especially for people who live a distance from it, just getting to either ocean.
Yeah.
Also the national parks, that's the places that are designated as beautiful and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think everyone has a spot that is sometimes, I know for me it's the ocean because that's where I was raised, and it's just going back there just dreams of peace.
Mm-hmm. A landscape. Terry Tempest Williams is writing about that. Certainly Kathleen Norris has written about the geography of faith landscape. Much is being written about the importance of wilderness. Those are all great examples.
What about Graceland? I think it's kind of goofy, but I mean, people go there, and from what I hear, people stand around and pray and cry. I don't know.
That's the first thing I think of when you talk about cultural places. Because it's not just that, I mean, I don't think there's anything to do there except to be
Well, and more recently, Ground Zero in New York City has become that kind of spot. And for a generation, I think the Oklahoma City bombing site also was that. What do you make of Graceland? It's a great suggestion.
I suspect that's one that's quite individualized, isn't it?
I think it's that there's a, I mean, that it's almost like, well, we'll call it this, and we'll give ourselves permission to see it as sacred, or see it as, and that you know, you can look at, that it's almost like because it's designated that, we can allow ourselves to get in the space of a pilgrim by going there. And it could be anywhere.
It's vitally important in some way. And there are these things that take us back to those memories. We heard, who did we hear with the South Dakota Symphony? Was it Flash Cadillac? They were performing with the South Dakota Symphony several years ago. We went to this concert. Second song they played, I turned to Sue and said, I think I was in seventh grade when that song came out. And then they played another song, I turned back to her and said, man, I'm glad I'm not in seventh grade. All of those feelings, those adolescent dance kinds of things were coming back, and it was like, yikes. Carol, I think before you came in, I mentioned that last week the Ken Burns documentary in the national parks happened out in the world. We only got to see one segment of it. And I think somebody's bringing that into the village. It may be worth watching some of those. In the first episode, it was so fascinating to learn that Yellowstone National Park, in many ways, was an accident of history, because Yosemite had already been set aside as separate, beautiful, protected land. The motivation at the time, this is mid-19th century, was to keep these other beautiful areas from becoming like Niagara Falls. They talked a long time about how Niagara Falls had become a disaster, how you couldn't even see the falls without approaching a vendor. And so there was this, so they set Yosemite aside for the California state legislature. But Wyoming was not yet a state. So there was nobody to whom to designate that. And they talked about how different it is that Yellowstone belongs to all of us and not just to the people of Wyoming. That was a big segment of that. I kind of want to press that a little and say, and I wonder if what Christians can offer in the realm of the creation, in believing that none of it belongs to us, it all belongs to God, and that we are stewards of this gift. There's a sense in which it being named a national park was heightening the ownership of that, because we own it, it belongs to us. I wonder if there's some way to say it doesn't belong to us that heightens the sanctity and importance and sacredness of it. Just a comment about the national parks.
I forget that guy's name. When Reagan was in office, the one who, you know,
oh, yeah.
Watts, yeah. And the big thing with him about how he felt like we as a people, meaning them as Republicans, do as they wished with nature and the parks and stuff like that, which to me seemed just the opposite of what you just said.
Right.
And that's kind of the danger or
the interesting thing about this documentary is the way it demonstrates the tension between protection and development that's been part of that story from the very beginning. That it was the development of the railroads that was popularizing the places, and therefore they're becoming popular, therefore the need to protect them. Oh, I think it is the opposite of what I just said in terms of doing whatever we please. Well, having just been to the wilderness, I can offer a little bit about liminal space. We camped at just up at Hart last night. We'd hung the bear bag before the sun went down because we knew it would get dark before we were through eating. And then we went back in the dark to hang our food. And it was amazing how tricky it was to find the bag, even though we knew pretty exactly where we'd hung. It was a bright color bag. Was one of those profound moments of how minuscule you are in the universe. And going to the creation, I think going to the ocean does that. We are a speck. But the awe is, in the same time that it reduces us, does it not enlarge us? And I think that's a part of that first article stuff, to recognize our smallness.
We went to Hawaii a couple years ago and went to the top of a mountain on the Big Island, which is 13,000 feet tall. And you go there at nighttime and you can go on a tour where they give you basically a star show after. And this is where many countries have huge telescopes because it's one of the darkest places on Earth. And I never knew that you could actually see the Milky Way. I mean, you could see the entire Milky Way. And that, once I realized that that was what it was just, I mean, talk about feeling like a speck. I just had no idea that there were that many stars in the sky. And I know it's like that up here too.
So that's one of the parts of a pilgrimage is to have that feeling small and minuscule in creation.
What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I was at your session the other day. I missed the first one, so I didn't really have a working definition of pilgrimage.
Okay.
But I was at the second one where you were showing, you know, go place in France and stuff like that. I mean, in Spain and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, I think historically it has meant many things. In the first session, I talked about the tension between the medieval view, which was tied up with either getting to Jerusalem or getting to the sites that were attributed to the saints, and the Celtic view, which was much more about becoming conformed to Christ. My working definition is a departure from daily life in trust of a sacramental encounter with God. So another way to raise this question is, are these sacramental encounters with God? Are we more aware of who God is and what God is doing? And it was interesting, we got this particularly out of the first example. I think my contention is that for that to happen, we need to function in more than one of these places. We'll just put that out there for a working hypothesis. That it was beautiful when Linda mentioned Ellis Island, because immediately it hit two of them. It's historic for our country, but it was also personal. And some of these experiences with creation, when we know salvation history and what the scripture assigns to the Creator, is also very powerful. For example, one of the places that I take students from our campus is Pine Ridge, South Dakota. It's a reservation about 5 hours drive out of Sioux Falls, so it's one of the shortest trips we take as a campus ministry trip. But I'm ready to argue it is one of the most cross-cultural. And I think the power of it is that it is both historic. You learn the history of the massacre that happened at Pine Ridge, for example, of the history of broken treaties. I mean, you can go to the sites and see what's happened. But you also get to know people who live there. I mean, we build a trip simply out of learning to get to know our neighbors and loving our neighbors. And the two of them together are very significant. When you see somebody who is a Vietnam veteran or a World War II veteran on the mall, it's clear that transcends that. So, go ahead.
But when I moved to the Northwest like 30 years ago from the Midwest, I was struck by how little, you know, how much less churched this part of the country is. And there are many, many, many people who live in the Northwest who see that creation aspect of what you're talking about as their church. I mean, they would say that they believe in God and that they see God in nature, but they don't have any connection with an organized religion, and they see their involvement in the wilderness and the mountain, you know, climbing Mount Rainier or you know, whatever it is, as their, you know, connection with creation. So, and that just, maybe it's where I was in my life at the time, but it seems a lot more common in this part of the world. So it sort of makes sense that Holden is here and not in Iowa or someplace. Not necessarily, yeah. But.
I think the church has always struggled to connect the two. Uh-huh. To keep the history of God's involvement with people and honoring the creation and the created order, to keep those connected. And I think they're both more powerful when we do. That would be my assertion. So what do we say about places like Branson, Missouri, and Las Vegas, and Disneyland? And what do we make of travel to those places and how popular it is?
A lot of praying goes on.
Where? In Las Vegas?
Not sure.
Go ahead.
I would say, you know, down at the bottom you said letting go and then sacramental.
Right.
And I think that's more the letting go side of it. It's somewhere we can go and forget about all the daily grind.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place to go let go.
Okay. Nancy, what do you think?
I think I would make a case for Disneyland being a little different. And this maybe speaking as a West Coast person. It's an actual kind of rite of passage for children, certainly in Seattle. There just comes a time about what age, Linda, probably when they're the oldest is 6 or 7 or mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. And this is the summer we go to Disneyland. And everybody goes. Mm-hmm. Everybody goes. It's without, I don't know that I know a family who has not taken their children to Disneyland. No, I'm talking about Seattle, the ones I know. Yeah. But it just is a regular thing. So it's a little different than like going on a vacation to Las Vegas or taking the family to France, and it's kind of got this little piece to it. And I'm also a Disneyland fan, which I'd be happy to talk about.
I agree with you, and we feel that it was one of the things we did to our kids that we never took them to Disneyland. We went camping and sailing and things like that, and we never went to Disneyland. And now they're saying to us, you have to go with us when we take the grandkids.
Yeah.
So we feel that we neglected our kids.
Well, let me say, can I say what's cool about Disneyland?
Yeah, absolutely, of course.
It really is a medieval fair.
Oh.
That's what Disneyland is. It's a medieval fair. You walk in and you are in that one place and everything's available to you. It's all very wholesome and all that kind of stuff too. But it has all those pieces. There are parades that wander through when you're not expecting them. There are people on stilts and larger than life kinds of things. And there are, you know, people doing little crafty things on the side, and there's the rides and all that stuff. But it really is. It's just, that's what it is. It's a medieval fair and you go for that. It's your day at the fair. Yeah,
it's very
yeah,
it like market like day.
Okay.
So there's an interesting piece there. I just thought I'd throw out.
Well, is that any different than, say, the Minnesota State Fair?
Might not be.
For some people, I don't think it is. But there's so much more fantasy.
Yeah. It really is stepping into an entirely different place for a day.
Mm-hmm. There's no big barns full of cows.
No.
To take the suspicious, cynical point of view, well, actually, just to take what I see as, you know, my point of view, which of course I see as
the true way to look at things.
I think the success of places like that speaks to marketers' expertise at looking at a hole in our culture and filling it with something expensive and artificial. I think that they know we're craving for the real thing. So we're craving for the medieval fair. You know,
so
or we're craving.
What would be the real thing then?
What would be the real thing?
The Minnesota State Fair.
There's a circus in Seattle where I think they've finally gone to megaphones, but they used to use a cone, and they have a little orchestra, and they have acrobats, and they do it on the street, and they do it in warehouses, and they do it. I mean, and when I saw that, I just went, wow, you know, this is the real thing. This is, and it had that same. I mean, that the silliness of the parades coming through. I mean, it had those elements, and Disneyland just had never struck me as that. It struck me more as a patriotic propaganda mechanism. Although I was right for seeing it that way. It's not, I mean, I don't see it as just that, but that's certainly how it struck me. You know, I think the success of those things speaks to whatever degree they truly do fill that space in us. The success of them sure does speak to that there's a big hole that we're looking to fill. Mm-hmm. And from my point of view, they found something to fill that hole and sell it for $400 a day, you know, for your family.
Well, and isn't it interesting that by many of the national parks that we have gone to, there's usually a town or a city close by that is full of one tourist trap after another.
It does the same
thing. Can it make Canada fill that hole?
Right.
You know?
I'm not sure if they're filling their hole. That hole is they are sort of skimming what's, you know, the crowd that's there for the other thing. But the national parks and things are free. I mean, close. I mean, they're pretty cheap, you know, as opposed to Disneyland. And does that make a difference in terms of a pilgrimage? I mean, are you supposed to find tons of money for a pilgrimage?
Can I comment about Ralph?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. See, I think Disneyland is the authentic place. Whereas, no, I'm making serious points about that kind of thing. And the original one is the first one. And whereas the marketing spinoff for Disney World, Epcot, you know, Disney Europe, all that kind of stuff, all the other gizmo kinds of things. So personally, I wouldn't go to any of those places. And I think Branson, Missouri and Las Vegas and things like that are all about, you know, I mean, what's this thing about having like a fake French? I feel all that. What is that about, you know, like in Las Vegas? But so I'm just making the one case for Disneyland as the out of that particular genre in our culture being the one authentic quote American pilgrimage site. That's the case I'm making.
But my question still holds is, are you supposed to fork out tons of money to go to on a pilgrimage?
Well, there's certainly historic precedent for that.
Yeah.
Pilgrimages in Europe built St. Peter's in Rome. At the time of the Reformation, the whole pilgrimage industry was so corrupt that Luther would have nothing to do with it. Luther writes very condemning things about pilgrimage. So in some Lutheran circles, I have to apologize for even exploring this whole idea. Fascinating thing in the discussion that I'm hearing, and I think it takes us back to Linda's comment about nature too, is I do think there is a hunger in us to be taken outside of ourselves. And I think some of where this discussion is going is what is authentic about that or not. And I think in defense of Disneyland, I would say creativity takes you out of yourself. Imagination, fantasy. We're showing Lord of the Rings as part of this whole program. I mean, there's a sense in which it does that. There's another sense in which it's so contrived, and I'm not sure about the creativity of that, finally. So the house burns in 32 seconds, and then whoosh, it's back to normal, and then it burns again. And it's amazing that they can do that. But it's...
In Disney?
Yeah. What is that? It's a movie set. I don't remember which one it was.
Speaking of burning, I think it's maybe a generational thing, but does anyone have any experience with the Burning Man Festival in Arizona?
We have never heard of it.
There's a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
I have never heard of it.
Oh, Burning Man.
Oh, my. Oh.
My
daughter wants to go, and I don't want her to go.
It's actually pretty okay. We have neighbors that go every year.
Really? Can you describe it, Nancy?
It's in a desert in Arizona.
Nevada.
Right, okay, one of those places. And it has, it's kind of like, how would you describe it?
It's a trip.
And they do have this big Burning Man in the middle of it, which is why it's called Burning Man. But it's gone on for a long time.
You're supposed to have a live person inside there.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I have never said that.
But it's kind of like Woodstock on steroids with a lot of marijuana around.
Okay. Or a landish costume, the better off you are.
People wear wild costumes. And
it's real creative. People kind of put themselves in like a robot kind of thing. And I mean, you have to build it yourself.
Yeah, you build it yourself.
And there's no money. I don't think you can. Everything's trade. You cannot.
Yeah, that's right.
We have another comment right here.
Well, I'm just, you know, listening to all this, and I'm going, you know, if you look at the two, let go and the sacramental thing, I can think back in my life of the places that I've been able to let go and have some sort of a feeling of God. Mm-hmm. It comes back to the creation area in the forests, in nature, mm-hmm. where I'm alone, or you know maybe with somebody. One of the spots here is I was up here 4 years ago, and we walked up to Heart Lake and went fishing. And there were three of us, and it was just out on that trail up through the mountains. And coming back down, it was in the afternoon, and the trees were turning color, and you know it was a beautiful day. And there was one place that I remember we stopped, and you could just see everything around you and not hear a sound. Just the wind and our footsteps was about it. And that, to me, pulled creation back into it. God was all around us. And so I was able to let go, but also that, when I go to like a Disneyland, I live the fantasy. The rides, the whole thing. And get off on what my kids enjoy. So.
But I wonder if you're being, you grew up in the woods.
Yes.
So I wonder if you're being here takes you back to your childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can remember as a child feeling taught in the forest about creation. So.
The theologians in the room know that there's a very cantankerous relationship between creation and history theologians, between natural and revealed theology. And that's what I mean by saying it's been really hard for us to hold that together. Celtic theology is becoming very popular, and it seems to have done that historically. So that it isn't just an experience of the beauty of the world and the wonder, because there is an ambiguity in creation that is also really destructive. But that it's focused in Christ Jesus, for whom that destruction is redemptive and renewing and giving life again. So one of the things that I am inclined to say is that you keep asking, what does it need to be a pilgrimage? I think I'm tempted to add something like intentionally complex into the definition. Jody Kretzmann teaches up here a lot, and he defines community as an intentionally complex relationship over time. And I wonder if a pilgrimage doesn't need to be an intentionally complex journey out of the ordinary. So it is the beauty of the woods, and it is the presence of a word, a revealed word that would speak in and through that beauty. Or it is something in your own history, and then it is finding connection with lots of other people for whom that's been true.
So what are some examples that anyone can think of? You look at the old church and the pilgrimage paths of the Islamic people, and of the one that John showed us in Spain and Iona, and those are connected with long church traditions, and I'm just trying to think, unless it's Mormons going to the temple or Salt Lake City, that I'm just trying to think of what do we have here.
I think a civil rights pilgrimage would be that very much. You know, I mentioned just the Martin Luther King Museum, but there are tours that will start at the plantations and include Lincoln sites and Civil War sites and Martin Luther King sites, Rosa Parks memorials, to walk that story and to hear how many times that is biblically informed, from Abraham Lincoln to Martin Luther King, obviously. I mean, I think that's a very good example. I think there are treks in nature that do that. The camping ministry of the church is a huge ministry of the church, and backpacking trips through the boundary waters, places where people are opened, this liminal space kind of thing that you're responding to, becomes concrete, and And the word speaks. I mean, it becomes sacramental. I can't resist one more Disneyland comment. This was at Disney World, Nancy.
That doesn't count.
Okay. Well,
it has a Magic Kingdom.
My cousin was a Benedictine nun for, I don't know, 11 or 12 years. And then she left the convent and married, had a family, and her kids got to the magic age. And she took them to Disney, albeit the wrong one, to Florida. And they were in Florida, and Disney at that point was exploring moving into planned communities.
Yeah, really.
And into education. And I think maybe they have done some of that. Well, my cousin Marie had all the qualifications. She had a master's degree, she was a certain age, she had kids a certain age, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So she could get a whole bunch of free tickets by going into this study program. And they presented their plans and were getting feedback from them. Well, when they brought Marie into it, they had no idea what they were getting. It was just delightful when she told me about it. She said, I gave them a good Benedictine view of renewal. And I said, this is creative, it's mesmerizing, it's fun, but it's all external. There is nothing here that forces you into yourself. Hence, a distinction between that and education. She said, we all had those classes in college. What did we call them? Mickey Mouse classes. Go, Marie. Yeah. But there is a sense. Susan brought up Holden early in the piece, and I expect we'll have more discussion about this. But just as we're working some Trinitarian theology in front of us and interfacing it with this experience of travel, I'll throw this out for discussion. My sense is that it's also been tricky for Holden to hold on to its theological roots in each of these areas, and that it's strongest when it does. But when, for example, it gets here and tries to be community, intense community for the folks who are here, but may lose sight of some of the transcendent history and the way theology and faith have been valued, it may be that if this gets too focused and misses some of the relationship with the land and its, I think if we get too far from the brokenness that created the place in the first place, it was mine, and that's really important to be in touch with. Intentionally complex, you know, to see it as a whole lot of things. It's not just going off to beautiful nature, but it's participating in a history that's really broken, that in some ways we're still trying to redeem, meeting a whole bunch of other people. It can be all three. And I would argue for it to be all three, intentionally complex. Anybody going to argue with me? That would be exciting.
I'm not going to argue with you, but not at all. Not many.
Too easy, Nancy. That's too easy.
You know, one thing that came up just now when you were talking about that, people coming to hold it and stuff. You know, a lot of times, like, somebody will come and we've changed the vesper schedule so we're not singing Holden Evening Prayer. You know, and they go, oh, I have to go. We didn't get to sing Holden Evening Prayer. My experience was ruined. But the, I'm not making light of this at all. But the thing is that the one of the issues I think about pilgrimage sites is, first of all, when you repeat them, there are expectations about the experience.
Right.
And some of them are repeatable. Probably the mundane ones, like Disneyland, are pretty repeatable in some ways. Places like Holden or Iona or Teze are not.
Yeah.
Because there's a different context and that depth you were talking about there, too. Mm-hmm. Then the other hazard is when you have a wonderful pilgrimage site like Holden and you want all your friends to come to. And then what you want them to have is the same experience you have. When a place is authentic, they'll have a different experience.
Right.
And that's often problematic for the initial leader.
Yeah,
it's not.
Yeah, it is.
Sometimes it's even problematic for us.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. I think it was our third time. It just wasn't quite as good
yeah.
as the first time. And now we've done it so many times that we don't
how we did this week. Yeah.
But it's true, in terms of when you invite other people into it.
Yeah.
Sometimes that makes me kind of nervous.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's the value of the repeated pilgrimage, is that after enough repetitions, you stopped having expectations because you've seen it, you've had different experiences with the same pilgrimage, and that you're just open to whatever it is that is there at that particular visit.
I think that's true. You know, I just thought of it, this is a ritual for us. I hadn't thought about whether this is a pilgrimage or not, but we always make it to one or two of the Church College Christmas festivals in the Midwest. The ELCA has a number of colleges, you know, within driving distance, and they all have marvelous heritages of music. But it's another place, Nancy, that the thing you're describing happens exactly. You go to the first one, and it is wow. You've been hundreds of robed, angelic, Norwegian Lutheran kids, you know, singing. It's just marvelous. And then you go to the second, third, and you start comparing.
Yeah.
We hear a couple different, and it's like, oh, that's really sick.
Yeah.
You know, that the, each one of them is a gift, and the gift is sufficient in and of itself.
There's something about pilgrimage. I wonder if we have to be willing to invest something and give up something,
right.
Be it a silent pilgrimage. I'm thinking we have a monastery on our island,
mm-hmm.
and people come. Of course, they don't know that they're probably going to have to milk the cow in addition to praying. But it's you have to be willing to just open yourself to whatever the experience is going to bring.
Exactly. The thing you have to give up is yourself.
That's it.
And it may be for a task you never dreamt you'd have to do. It may be for your expectations and whether or not your expectations are being met. And that's why one of you asked a really profound question after the first session Monday night about the difference between chosen and forced pilgrimages. And that's where that distinction breaks down. That finally, when you have to let go of yourself, in the presence of whatever the journey may be. And the more that is true of an experience, and I do think Trinitarian theology helps us get at a breadth of that, as opposed to, so I mean, theologically, of course, the reason that we have the Trinity is because people would have some experience and believe they had all of God, and that the rest of God was somehow not needed.
Can you explain the letting go of yourself? What would that look like?
Well, one of the things that I hope we're going to do sometime in this is tell departure stories. So, you know, what come to my mind are times we have had departures that we hadn't planned, and we just had to give ourselves over to them. I told you when I talked about Lindisfarne briefly that first night that our being there, you don't mind if I tell the story, do you? Well, maybe she does mind.
I've pretty much got no.
You know, I told you Lindisfarne is a peninsula, and then at high tide it becomes an island. So we took the train to Linda's, to whatever town you get off, and then the buses were busy, so we had to take a cab. It was a $40 cab ride out to Lindisfarne, but it was the right tide, and we got out there. We got settled into our hotel, got to our room. Susan took off, you know, her pack and screamed, "I don't have the passports."
I didn't have the bag.
The bag that our passports were in. Well, high tide is coming. So we have to make a decision if we get off this island. We don't have a motel reservation in the other place. I mean, it's a long story. We went down to the desk, and the person at the desk was very helpful. We could not resolve this by ourselves. We needed the help of the train. We remembered where we were at the train. The desk clerk was very compassionate. It was... Well, there were some parts of it that were a marvelous experience. This was a Friday. We were flying on Sunday, so we had one day to get our passports back. And this guy at the desk kept saying, I'm not a religious person, but I'm praying for you. Okay with me. That is an example. I think of more intense examples. I will never forget the day we left our first kid at college, or our second or third kid. They are departures. And you let go of how you think it's going to go. Death, disease, loss of job, any of these kinds of experiences can be. What I said in the first session was that I think the liminal experience in travel is not in itself so significant, except that it's practice in all the liminal experiences in life, the times we need to let go. And I have a quotation in the paper that talks about how finally all of them take us to Jerusalem and the cross. It's so fascinating that change is kind of is such a radical word for Christian people, because there is no more radical change than the cross, or no more absolute letting go.
You know, there's another side to that too. When you think you're going on a pilgrimage, especially to a very holy spot like Jerusalem or Bethlehem, and you're going to think, you think you're going to see the spot where, you know, Christ was supposed to have been born, and then you find yourself in this spot with 35 Korean Christians who are taking pictures of each other at the exact spot, and it's totally different than you think it's going to be.
That's exactly right. Nancy has another story.
Remember in 2000, Pope John Paul II went on pilgrimage to the Holy Land?
Yeah.
And there's a controversy about the location of where John the Baptist actually did baptizing, based on the scripture, kind of two names of places. And all the marketers in each place insisted that theirs was the right place, and the Pope had better come to the right place, or all these hundreds of years of marketing this place was going to go right out the window. It was huge. It was big. He went in either place, but he finally decided to do it. So to make so that the people of the community could keep their livelihoods, which is marketing all the tourists.
One of the reasons I love this topic is because everybody's got stories. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem is one of the sites commemorating Golgotha and the tomb, etc., etc. And it's, what, 17 chapels kind of pasted together? It's gauche and loud, and you know, it's not reflective at all. Well, then, now they've developed a garden tomb outside the city walls, with a big hill that could look like a skull. They've got spots there for groups of pilgrims together for worship. So when we were in Jerusalem, our group was going to have a communion service there. And so we're in the middle of the reading of the gospel, and it is the passion narrative. You're at the spot, and it's in worship, etc., etc., etc. And a bird dropped right on my arm. Well, it happened, and I had to deal with it, and I didn't have any Kleenex, since I were poking people down the row for Kleenex. And at the, you know, the thing that I will say in Vespers tonight is I think some of it is learning to, the middle part is about paying attention, and it's about paying attention sideways to the things happening around us. May not be what you thought it was going to be.
Except the way you didn't know God had a sense of humor.
Yeah, exactly. And but there are other things that happen that are really profound and really wonderful. And
at
so,
least expected time.
Yeah. Go ahead.
While you're talking here, we're talking about pilgrimages, and we've been focusing on going to places, physical places.
Yeah.
Actually, the pilgrimage is the letting go, isn't it? Is the... You talk about change being difficult. It's letting go and allowing change to happen. And that could be a pilgrimage in this sitting in a pew in church of hearing a message and allowing yourself to accept that message that may not be exactly what you heard or what you believed up until now. place, but it's actually a change inside yourself.
Well, first I will tell you that I absolutely believe that that happens, that you hear a word and the word changes you in all kinds of places. I think one of the things about departure is that your body is in a different place and you have to deal with that. And so you have let go of some things. And it may be that spiritual letting go is the same thing or even more profound. Certainly when people become aware of the depth of their addiction and they turn. Nancy is helping me hear some real parallels between the 12-step spirituality and pilgrimage. That is a letting go of a sense of self and a sense of control and facing a brokenness. I don't have any problem calling that a pilgrimage at all. But I think, or acknowledging that that's real, one of the things that I'm just aware that when you've made a geographic move, you're forced to confront it in some ways. The passports are gone and you're flying in a day. Tide is rising. And it's more than just thinking about a new approach to getting home. You know, there gets to be some urgencies in that movement. What I'm after, I should be clear about what I'm after, because campus ministry supports service learning on our campus, and because undergraduates are traveling more and more and more, but I don't know that they're reflecting more and more, is I'm after this kind of reflection and awareness on what's happening, which includes naming a willingness to let go. Carol, you were going to make a comment.
I was just going to ask if there's something about pilgrimage that implies a kind of relative safety. I mean, we don't set out on a pilgrimage not thinking we're going to return home. I mean, you know, it's a little more, in some ways it's a little less risky. We want to put ourselves in a place where we're open to something happening to us, but not, we don't want to let go of everything.
Okay.
And so there's, you know, I mean, in so many of the things that we've talked about as potential possible pilgrimages, there's kind of a safety involved.
Mm-hmm.
You're not too far out on a limb. You may be liminal, but not.
Yeah.
Not
way off
that. Yeah. It's one of your expectations. That's really.
You're just a few steps further out on the limb than you are thinking about it. You know. And obviously, there are degrees of that. A bus tour where everybody handles your luggage, and you know, anything going wrong is somebody else's problem, and they need to take care of that. It's much less a pilgrimage than.
So are you saying a pilgrimage is where there is some danger or where there isn't?
I'm saying where the danger is perhaps somewhat controllable. I mean, you know, you choose which pilgrimage you're going to go on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different than moving to a new place.
Yeah.
Where you don't know, you know, you're not expecting.
I mean, you're putting yourself in possibly in harm's way, but maybe not that much.
Yeah, I think it depends what you understand the danger. To
yeah.
be. You know, I have taken colleagues who teach Native American culture and history on our campus to Pine Ridge. And they have become aware of things they were teaching that when they had to do it. For example, one of the profs had always started his classes talking about how you don't make direct eye contact with somebody who's older than you. That's seen as disrespectful. And so there's this gentleman in the room talking to us about Native American history and culture. And Bill finds himself making direct contact. And a cross-cultural experience plays with your mind. You go thinking we're going to find both end solutions, and you realize it's way more difficult than you imagined. I think that's playing with fire. I think that has a lot of capacity to change people. I think living among the poor does too, in other kinds of service ventures. So yeah, we buy a round trip ticket and we're going to come home, but I think we don't have the foggiest idea what might be threatened in the what we might learn of ourselves. But it's a very good question, and I want to think about it some more. Because safety clearly is a contradiction of the letting go of self.
I was just thinking, as you were talking now, about we hosted a foreign exchange student for a year. And it's so easy to think about that perhaps Rachel from Australia was on pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. But hosting her was also a pilgrimage for us, I think, because there was a lot of things we learned about ourselves, and in many ways, we had to let go.
We said it gave us new humility over world peace.
Because it was difficult.
It was very challenging. Well, we are on a journey to see what we can figure out about pilgrimage. Thank you so much for helping. And we'll carry on with the discussions. See you at dinner.